On a January evening of the early 70s, Christine Nilsson was singing Faust at the Academy of Music in New York. Although there was already talk of the erection, in remote metropolitan distances above the 40s, of a new opera house, which should compete in costliness and splendor with those of the great European capitals, the world of fashion was still content to reassemble every winter in the shabby red and gold boxes of the sociable old Academy. Conservatives cherished it for being small and inconvenient, and thus keeping out the new people whom New York was beginning to dread and yet drawn to, and the sentimental cling to its historic associations and the musical for its excellent acoustics, always so problematic a quality in halls built for the hearing of music. When Newland Archer opened the door at the back of the club box, the curtain had just gone up on the garden scene. Leaning against the wall at the back of the club box, he turned his eyes from the stage and scanned the opposite side of the house. Directly facing him was the box of old Mrs. Manson Mingott, whose monstrous obesity had long since made it impossible for her to attend the opera, but who was always represented by some of the younger members of the family. On this occasion, the front of the box was filled by her daughter-in-law, Mrs. Lovell Mingott, and her daughter, Mrs. Welland. And slightly withdrawn behind these brocaded matrons sat a young girl in white, with eyes ecstatically fixed on the stage lovers. A warm pink mounted to the girl's cheek, mantled her brow to the roots of her braids, and suffused the younger slope of her breast to the line, where it met a modest tucker fastened with a single gardenia. She dropped her eyes to an immense bouquet of the lilies of the valley on her knee, and Newland Archer saw her white-gloved fingers touch the flowers softly. He drew a breath of satisfied vanity. "The darling," thought Newland Archer, "she doesn't even guess what it's all about." And he contemplated her absorbed young face with a thrill of possessionship, in which pride in his own masculinity was mingled with a tender reverence of her abysmal purity. It was only that afternoon that May Welland had let him guess that she cared, New York's consecrated phrase of maiden avowal, and already his imagination, leaping ahead of the engagement ring, the betrothal kiss and the march from the Lohengrin, pictured her at his side in some scene of old European witchery.
You've been listening to a reading from the opening pages of Edith Wharton's novel, The Age of Innocence. Welcome to A Novel Idea. This is Rosemary Manchester, your host. My guests in the studio are Heidi Farini and Aaron Sheffield, and they're joining me for a conversation about Edith Wharton and The Age of Innocence. In the second half of our show, we'll feature my conversation with Katie Casbin, Copperfield's new events coordinator. The Age of Innocence was published in 1920 and concerns events in Manhattan in the 1870s among the very wealthy people. What possible relevance this could have in our modern lives? And so I ask Heidi and Aaron to join me. Heidi Farini is a bookbinder. She creates beautiful handmade books. She's also a conservator of books. People bring her family treasures that have fallen upon hard times, and she meticulously reconstructs and restores these books. Welcome, Heidi. Aaron Sheffield is a volunteer at the Gold Ridge Experimental Farm in Sebastopol, where she trains the docents, and she's also in charge of publicity. Aaron says that her goal is to make the experimental farm better known, and she puts a great deal of energy into this work. Thanks to your work, Aaron, and welcome. Our readers will notice that in the very beginning of the book, Edith Wharton sets the scene in the Opera House, one of four opera houses in New York at the time. She wrote this book when she was 58, and a great deal of it is based on people she knew, events that took place in New York. So she's looking back over her life. And Heidi, I always find it amusing that every time our protagonist, Newland Archer, is referred to in this passage, both names are used. And that's probably a sign of the formality of the times.
I have a feeling it was. Perhaps life was very much more formalized, especially in that particular set.
Yes.
So that it's very likely that, it was the mode of
yes.
the time.
And although you grew up in a place far from New York, I know that you noticed many of the same customs of society that were prevalent in New York at the time.
It's true. I grew up in Sydney, Australia, and of course that's part of the Commonwealth. But I do think that everything had to do with emulating back to the crown, you know, back to England. And even though Australia and obviously the US were independent, and the US even more so, not being part of the Commonwealth, there's still this nostalgia and this desire to be much like society in England. So it was far-reaching.
And so when you were growing up in Australia, you were conscious of the class distinctions as they were practiced there.
Well, I think they were, perhaps a little less so, but there certainly were distinctions. There were, from an educational point of view, there were the private schools and there were the public schools. And there was more activity in terms of the social network, if you want to call it that, amongst the private schools. And that was visible throughout the country.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And Erin, you grew up in New York, is that right?
Yes, I did. Mm-hmm. In Manhattan.
And of course, it was a time much later than the time that's written about in Age of Innocence, which actually, I noticed that first sentence, she said in the 70s. And I did, well, now that would be the 1870s, wouldn't it? So you were many generations removed from the social structures that she writes about. And yet I believe you encountered some of the same classifications of society that Edith Wharton speaks of so eloquently.
Very much so. I was a child of the 50s, born in 39, but in the 50s when I was growing up and becoming aware of society and reading The Age of Innocence, it took me back to my tribe.
Your tribe, wonderful. Wharton's expression. Yes, go ahead.
Right, but I used that
yes,
term
of
even before reading the book.
Ah.
Because I've lived in California now for 40 years, but when I go back to New York and I get together with my friends from high school, I feel as though I've gone back to my tribe.
Tell us some of the practices of your tribe.
Well, I could say that when I was a teenager, that New York society was in its last throes of the rigidity that Edith Wharton describes so beautifully in The Age of Innocence. For example, I was a debutante, not because of my blue blood, which I only had a quarter blue blood, if you will. No, maybe half. But such things were still important in the 50s. And in order to be a debutante, you started to go to subscription dances in high school. And that was after having gone to the correct dancing schools, so that you would know how to do the Viennese waltz, say, at your debut. And in order to go to these subscription dances, you had to be approved by the committee. And the committee was composed of Mrs. David Harrington, et cetera. Of course, the wives all always went those days by their husbands' names. And if you didn't know a member of the committee, you had to know somebody who knew a member of the committee who would write a letter for you. Or I should say your mother had to know someone. And not only that, but at the most exclusive dances, Even the young men had to be known or be known by somebody who knew a member of the committee. It's so antediluvian today, but that's the way it was.
It's amazing how quickly that all passed.
Yes.
Now let's listen to another excerpt from the very beginning of Age of Innocence. And Edith Wharton is introducing the three main characters. We've already had a glimpse of Newland Archer looking across the opera house at his fiancée, Mae Welland.
Newland Archer saw with surprise the entry of a new figure into old Mrs. Mingott's box. It was a slim young woman, a little less tall than Mae Welland, with brown hair growing in close curls about her temples and held in place by a narrow band of diamonds. The suggestion of this headdress, which gave her what was then called a Josephine look, was carried out in the cut of a dark blue velvet gown, rather theatrically caught up under her bosom by a girdle with a large old-fashioned clasp. The wearer of this unusual dress, who seemed quite unconscious of the attention it was attracting, stood a moment in the center of the box, discussing with Mrs. Welland the propriety of taking the latter's place in the front right-hand corner. Newland Archer was thrown into a strange state of embarrassment. It was annoying that the box, which was attracting the undivided attention of masculine New York, should be that in which his betrothed was seated between her mother and her aunt. And for a moment he could not identify the lady in the empire dress, nor imagine why her presence created such excitement among the initiated. Then light dawned on him, and with it came a momentary rush of indignation. The young woman was Mae Welland's cousin, the cousin always referred to in the family as poor Ellen Olenska. Archer knew that she had suddenly arrived from Europe a day or two previously. She sat gracefully in her corner of the box, her eyes fixed on the stage, and revealing, as she leaned forward, a little more shoulder and bosom than New York was accustomed to seeing, at least in ladies who had reasons for wishing to pass unnoticed. Few things seemed to Newland Archer more awful than an offense against taste. Madame Olenska's pale and serious face appealed to his fancy as suited the occasion and to her unhappy situation. But the way her dress, which had no tucker, sloped away from her thin shoulders shocked and troubled him. He hated to think of Mae Welland's being exposed to the influence of a young woman so careless of the dictates of taste.
You're listening to A Novel Idea. My partners in conversation this evening are Heidi Farini and Aaron Sheffield, and we're talking about Edith Wharton's book, The Age of Innocence. In the readings that we've heard, we are introduced to the three main characters, Newland Archer, who seems always to go by both of his names, and his fiancée, Mae Welland, and the mysterious Countess Ellen Olenska. The dynamic among the three of them, I think, is what carries the story. Would you say, Heidi?
The interaction between the three of them, or not between the three of them, is paramount to the story.
And the fact that Wharton made the two of them cousins, Mae Welland and Ellen Olenska, somehow heightens the tension, because there's a bond that we detect between the two women, and they're Newland Archer, newly engaged to Mae, but obviously attracted to Ellen.
Yes, yes.
And in those days, that wasn't particularly condoned.
Well, obviously it wasn't condoned, but it's just a wonderful, realistic piece of information.
Yes.
That she writes about to underscore the fact that this probably was, you know, in the thoughts of many, many, many young men and or women too. But yeah, it wasn't condoned.
And the emotions are so repressed.
Mm-hmm. And Edith Wharton writes so well about this. She has a turn of phrase that's just marvelous. And there's a piece here that I think that sort of says it. In reality, they all lived in a kind of hieroglyphic world where the real thing was never said or done or even thought, but only represented by a set of arbitrary signs. And I think that's kind of the essence of it, isn't it? Scary.
And one of those arbitrary signs, I suggest, is whether the men wore patent leather pumps or Oxfords with their evening clothes. This really struck a note when I read it, because I had a beau whom I was madly in love with, and he was very proud of his patent leather pumps.
Uh-oh.
Now, whether one should wear patent leather pumps or Oxfords was decided by the man who the novel says he was the authority on form. And so one had to do what the emperor of form said and that one must do in order to be an acceptable and indeed invited member of society.
What happens if he broke the rules?
Well, then you weren't invited.
His career as a social butterfly was over.
If one didn't adhere to the rules of dress, mm-hmm. as in the amount of shoulder that or bosom mm-hmm. that could be shown, mm-hmm. then one just stopped being invited and gradually realized they were no longer acceptable and might even sink to becoming common.
Common. Oh, goodness.
Yes.
Well, this is why Madame Olenska is a fine example of what could go wrong and what actually did go wrong.
Do you want to tell her story?
She was married to a count in Europe, and this did not go well. So she really had no recourse but to come home, which she did, and then her relatives were certainly part of the New York society, but she was looked upon with great question because she wasn't adhering to the rules.
And at one point, she thought about divorce because she thought perhaps that would improve her situation.
Right.
But the divorce was just unthinkable. It wasn't something that was done. I mean, you would be, cast out of society?
You could be. And so rather than that, she was encouraged to go back. And that would have been just fine with everybody because it would have meant that she was out of their hair. And it didn't matter to that society what happened to her, really, so long as she wasn't being a nuisance to them. And that's really what it was.
Yes. Oh, one so feels for Ellen Olenska.
Very much.
And in many cases, she seems so baffled at encountering these barriers and these customs. She thought that she could return home and be among her own people and be cherished and have a life. Mm-hmm. And one doesn't seem to get a chance to be reinstated in that society. And it seems like one mistake and one is doomed. She wrote this book in 1920. And, you know, we think of the roaring 20s and the, the young women in short skirts dancing the Charleston and a great deal of drinking, an entirely different sort of a Gatsby society we think about in the 20s, so far removed from this glacial society in which people seem almost frozen in time and in place and so constrained by the etiquette of the time. Were these things going on at the same time? I mean, it was one class doing the Charleston and another doing the Viennese waltz, or what would the timing have been?
Well, I look at it as eras, and I suggest that the social revolution that occurred in this country in the 60s was no more extreme a change from the glacial 50s
mm-hmm. yes.
than the roaring 20s mm-hmm. were from the Age of Innocence mm-hmm. or the Gilded Age.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a bit about Edith Wharton. She finished this book in 1920, and she was 58. And obviously it wasn't her first book. A number of wonderful novels from Edith Wharton. And then in 1921, she won the Pulitzer Prize. One of the critics said that's the first time that a novel that he thought was worth winning the Pulitzer Prize had won. And it was quite a tribute. And particularly as we are celebrating Women's History Month and focusing on the women authors. And she said that this book was a long gaze backward across the ruins of time. I mean, that seems such a melancholy way to describe her work. But she had suffered many of these same problems of being excluded in society as her protagonist.
Yes, because she was an artist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, oh, that's right. That was not socially acceptable.
These people were not artists. They were not creative.
Yes.
They had their rules, they had their standing, they had enough money that they didn't need to create. The men worked as lawyers or stockbrokers or perhaps in the family business, but not too terribly hard because the rent was going to be paid. And of course, there was no such thing. I say that. There was no rent to be paid because people owned their own homes in those days of this in this society. There was so much money.
And one of the extremely wealthy couples, instead of building a brownstone, built their home of a light-colored stone. And this was a tremendous subject of discussion, why they had chosen a different shade of stone to build their particular edifice. Right.
Right.
The smallest thing would entertain.
And, of course, I find that particularly ironic since the brownstones that I had visited in New York were terribly dark.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
And lots of stairs, and they were narrow. So there were windows only in the front and the back. Mm-hmm. And it was up and down stairs and up and down stairs.
Yes.
Well, of course, a lot of them now have been converted into apartments.
Yes. Originally, one family would own the entire building and live on in all of those rooms.
Right.
And then today, there are probably very few brownstones that are left in the original condition.
Right.
In the particular copy of Age of Innocence that I have, I found this description in the preface of the city of New York. Cramped, horizontal gridiron of a town without towers, porticos, fountains, or perspective. It sounds so bleak. And when you think of dazzling New York today, I mean, with all those eccentric buildings and each architect trying to outdo the others with eccentricities, it's amazing the change just in the geography of New York.
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm. Well, conformity, of course, was the word of the day, the watchword of the day amongst moneyed New York society.
Yes.
And then down in the Lower East Side, you had the appalling poverty of the immigrants. Mm-hmm. And in between the tradespeople who catered to the needs of the wealthy. Mm-hmm.
And, of course, this was before there were any automobiles. So the carts drawn by horses and the carriages drawn by horses mm-hmm. are very, very important in this story. And the anonymity that one could have by being concealed in a carriage, we don't have that today with automobiles and scooters and bicycles and skateboards mm-hmm. and everything else. Mm-hmm. One of the things you come across is the universality of experience, of the, you know, the triangle.
The love triangle, yes.
Yes, the love triangle.
The forbidden romance. Mm-hmm. I think of Anna Karenina, and there was a forbidden love. She was the one who suffered because of it. But that's one of the, they say there are only four or five great themes of in fiction,
yes,
in all of world literature.
Right.
And this forbidden love is certainly one of the largest and most fertile.
That's right.
But Edith Wharton had a very interesting life.
Oh,
in
yes.
That first of all, she married somebody, and I understand that the marriage wasn't even consummated.
Yes.
So, but he was a society person, so it was the right thing to do. But that wasn't at all happy. And even before she married, she knew she wanted to write, but it was very difficult for anything to be published. I think some small short stories were published under the aegis of her mother's kindness, perhaps, but not very much. So she left New York and she went to live in Europe. And I don't know how many years she spent there, but a good long time.
Mm-hmm.
And she never really mingled with all of the people who were in Paris at the time. She kept pretty much to herself. But I think it's so interesting that she would have written then so incredibly beautifully about the society that she grew up in.
That's interesting that she had to go to Europe to feel
yes.
comfortable, or that's where to get away from the stratification mm-hmm. of society in New York. And I moved from New York to California for the same reason, because in California I could be who I was, not where I went to school. Not who I knew. I had a clean slate. I didn't feel as though I had to live up to the expectations that were presented to me.
And Edith Wharton probably began to feel uncomfortable once she'd begun to publish. And she was mining the experiences, and people would have been able to identify certain characteristics of themselves in some of the characters in her books. And I could see why she'd want to get out of town and start Boston wasn't far enough away. That was more of the same. So she went to Europe. And as I recall, she had at least one love affair. Later in life, when she was in Europe, and one does feel so happy for her that she found some happiness there.
Yes, yes.
Right.
I think that was important. And so I think she writes very well about this typical love triangle, because
yes.
she experienced some of this.
Mm-hmm. I do want to mention the movie.
Oh, the movie, yes. Mm. Oh, yes.
It is superb.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And it adheres so closely to the book.
Yes.
It's a joy. It's a visual joy, and it captures perfectly, I think, the whole social structure.
Right.
And it was directed by Martin Scorsese. Daniel Day-Lewis plays Newland, and Michelle Pfeiffer is a beautiful Countess Olenska. And Winona Ryder couldn't be more virginal, more blushing, more innocent. It's perfectly cast as Mae Welland.
I must get that. I don't think I've seen it. At least I haven't seen it for years.
You'll love it. And all the silverware and the china. Because in those days, you had a fork for everything and a different knife. There was a fish knife, and then there was the meat knife, and then there was the butter knife. And that was all part of social status.
Knowing which one to pick up next.
Yes, yes, which fork to use. And, of course, this was to the great advantage of Tiffany's and Black Star and Gorham, all the silverware manufacturers. And I still have a book from my grandmother's of old trunk in the attic of the correct settings, silver settings for the young bride, so that in choosing your silver pattern, you would know how many forks and how many spoons and how many knives you needed. And it was kind of like the diamonds you wore on your hair or on your gown and the silver on your table and the china and the crystal, et cetera, et cetera. And, of course, all the servants to keep everything going.
Are they ever mentioned in the book? Because one is conscious there must be an army of servants behind the scenes taking care of all those clothes and those that silver and those horses.
In the very beginning, when Mrs. Buford.
Oh, yes, we must talk about the Bufords, yes.
But she went to the opera.
Yes.
Even though she was holding her annual opera ball after opening night at the opera. And it's as it says in the book, she showed up at the opera, and this was an indication that she had enough servants to make sure everything was properly done for the opera ball that would follow shortly after. And also it says that one never showed up on time for the opera.
Oh, that's right. Fashionably late.
Right.
I'm talking with Heidi Farini and Aaron Sheffield. We're going to take a short break. Later in the broadcast, we'll hear from Katie Caspin, the new events coordinator at Copperfields. We'll be right back.
The ballroom was filled with fashion's throng. It shone with a thousand lights. And there was a woman who passed along, the fairest of all the sights. A girl to her lover then softly sighed, there's riches at her command. But she married for wealth, not for love, he cried, though she lives in a she seems to be. 'Tis sad when you think of her wasted life, for youth cannot mate with age, and her beauty was sold for an old man's gold. She's a bird in a gift.
And welcome back to A Novel Idea. I'm talking with Heidi Farini and Aaron Sheffield. The Beauforts are an interesting couple. It was her money, and he was a bit of a hustler. No one quite respected him, and yet because they had this ballroom, they were included in society. And then later, when he made some unfortunate financial mistakes and lost a lot of his money and lost a lot of money of the people in the book, they were ostracized. And she wanted to still maintain her friendships, but everyone was scandalized. No, her place is with him. How dare she show up? I thought that was revealing, but also so cruel.
Very cruel.
Mm-hmm. Particularly when it was her money that he lost.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But I guess that's the way it was in those days.
It was. Yes. Surely she made her bed, she had to lie in it, and that was that.
That was that.
Yeah.
I want to ask your opinion about Newland Archer. He was engaged to May Welland, but obviously he was drawn to Ellen Oleska. And yet it never seemed to occur to him that he could break his engagement for Ellen. And it seemed to be unthinkable. But these days, I think it would be thinkable.
Oh, definitely these days.
Sure, because Ellen Olenska could get a divorce in 1, 2, 3.
Yes.
But she wasn't divorced when she left Europe, when she came back to New York. So she really wasn't available. If I recall, he made a trip down to Florida, which was not that easy in those days, to suggest to May that they move up their wedding date, kind of to totally unaware that he was doing this to save himself from scandal of getting it really involved with Ellen Olenska.
And then there's that wonderful scene where he meets Ellen Olenska in Boston, and he's, you know, he's so inarticulate. Isn't there some way that we could be together? And she says, well, what you're asking is for, I'm paraphrasing, of course, is to be your mistress. And he said, oh, words are just not adequate to explain. And, you know, he just can't deal with what he's actually wishing to do, proposing, but thinking, wouldn't it be wonderful if we could still have a love affair? Mm-hmm. And she has to be the realist in the situation and say, what you're suggesting is not possible. Then he kind of goes away and sulks about it because he can't have them both.
He can't deal with it. He's so basically straight-laced and so involved in the society that he's in. But of course he can use his fantasy, can't he?
Yeah. I mean, and the Wellands are extremely wealthy, his fiancée and then his wife's family.
Right.
If he didn't marry May, Ellen didn't have any money. She was living off the grace of her relatives and I guess a small trust fund.
Right.
So he really would have had no future that in his own eyes unless he married May.
That's right, because his job at the lawyer's office was negligible. He really didn't do very much there.
None of them made any contributions to society in the way of work. I just couldn't get over that. One of the saddest parts of the entire book is at the very end. You remember the scene? He's not exactly old, but he's elderly. The children that he and May have had are grown up and married and have their own children. May has died. He's free, to reconnect with Ellen, but when he has the opportunity, he doesn't do it. He turns away. And that seemed to me so sad. He just, maybe it never occurred to him that they could build a life together at that point.
Or maybe he was afraid of losing the dream of his youth, of this great love of his life. And that would have just destroyed that whole beautiful, unconsummated love affair of his youth.
The fantasy.
The fantasy.
He couldn't risk
big romance.
The fantasy being true. Mm-hmm. Those of you who have not yet read The Age of Innocence by Edith Wharton, don't think that you know the whole story just because we've been talking about some of the incidents of the plot. It's a wonderful read. It's a... In a way, it's an old-fashioned book in that it takes its time, develops the characters, moves them through the arc of their lives, and so much detail of place. It really makes you feel how it must have been to live in Manhattan in the last days of the 19th century. And particularly if you've been extremely wealthy.
Only way to be.
That was definitely.
Which position it would have been the most desirable in those days.
Right.
And so I would encourage people to take a look at Edith Wharton. I always forget the name of the one with Lily Bart in it.
House of Mirth.
House of Mirth.
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Well, the quality of the writing, of course, is fabulous. I'm completely smitten with how she writes because it's just how she can say things so beautifully. And I love to quote things. Here's one little quote.
Oh, yes.
Beyond the small and slippery pyramid which composed Mrs. Archer's world, that's Newland's mother, lay the almost unmapped quarter inhabited by artists, musicians, and people who wrote. She can say in very few words, she can sum a big, big issue up. And of course, as much as I like this book, she only wrote about the society in which she was in. And as you mentioned before, the servants were not mentioned very much. There's nothing about how they lived. There's nothing about how the artists lived. So there are huge segments of life that haven't been talked about by her. I'm sure other people wrote about them.
Do you remember when you first read Edith Wharton?
Yes, and it wasn't very long ago because, I mean, she's American and I didn't grow up here. Uh-huh. So I really only was introduced to her by my book club.
Interesting.
So,
interesting.
Looking to the future now, with so much of the American average income concentrated in the top 10% or even 1% of the population, this is going, I think already it's is leading to another gilded age, because there is a very small group of oligarchs who have so much money and can live such a lifestyle, and there has been so much graft and dishonesty on the part of people who do not need this money to eat or have a roof over their heads. And so I wonder if this is how this is going to affect society and the upper economic class in this country and maybe across the whole world, with so much wealth concentrated in so few hands, and how that will affect that particular stratus.
I want to thank you both so much for coming, Heidi Perini and Erin Sheffield, and particularly this chance to talk about Edith Wharton and the Age of Innocence. So thanks so much for coming in.
Pleasure.
Welcome.
I recently met Katie Casbin, who is the new events coordinator at Copperfield, and couldn't wait to bring her onto the show. Welcome, Katie.
Thank you so much.
You're going to be good news for the literary community of Sonoma County, and I'm delighted that you're here.
Thank you so much.
And also, you know, we're so lucky to have Copperfield's books. Independent bookstores, I don't know if people realize how important they are. I know writers do, because their chances of having their books seriously considered at an independent bookstore are much stronger than if they were in one of the large chain stores.
Absolutely. We're definitely not a chain.
Right.
We're more of a family of bookstores.
Oh, that's a nice way to put it.
So what's great about that is you have your people are very proprietary, I'm finding, for the My Copperfields, which I love. Yes. So the My Copperfields in Sebastopol has a feeling about it, and these kind of events work here. This is what I'm learning. The Petaluma store, we've got Patty and Grace, who run the kids program there, and they are fantastic. They are incredible what they do in the schools. I don't know if people realize how much they take authors, go through the different schools. Kids have a chance to meet authors, talk to them, and then they'll have an event at the bookstore that night. The idea of community is, I think, Copperfields is doing a great job.
Yeah. And your Healdsburg store is so attractive.
Oh, I love Healdsburg, and they have this amazing little restaurant there gelato. So jealous.
I know.
So jealous. And then Montgomery Village, of course, has a little coffee shop in it. And if I lived there, I would probably just be there all the time reading
there.
A book, which is so awesome. And we encourage hanging out in the bookstore. And so, yeah. And then we've even got Calistoga up there. So when you're up taking a bath, go get a magazine, enjoy. And then Napa, of course, is a great store. There's a lot going on in that village where Napa is, but I think that's one of the coolest stores we have. There's different levels, and it's just an awesome vibe there.
Uh-huh. It sounds like a huge task.
It's a little overwhelming at the beginning.
But you are up for it. You've done so many things in your life, and just from chatting with you, I think you've been everywhere.
Just about.
And that puts you in such a strong position. You have such a great understanding of the world and some of the more remote parts of the world.
Yes, I am. I started out life in the Philippines, and my mom was in the Air Force. So we moved around quite a bit all around the globe. And then I just continued the tradition. And that has kind of gone with my jobs up until now, too. So I've been everything from a Domino's pizza delivery girl all the way up to working for a hospitality for the Beijing Olympics. So it's been crazy.
Quite.
But fun.
Quite a resume. I'm impressed. Yeah. You have some very interesting events coming up.
Yes, we do. We have our events calendar is out, so check the website, copperfieldsbooks.com. So it's copperfields with an S, books.com, all one word.
But that's easy.
Yes, Copperfields Books. We have a section on the website that has meet and greets. So on the right side of the website, you'll see events by location. And so you can go directly to your store, your favorite store, and find out what's happening there.
It's always such a wonderful mix. Copperfields is noted for supporting the many, many local writers, and the local writers are so appreciative of having a voice at Copperfields. And then in addition to that, you snag the celebrities as they are on their book tours.
We do have some incredible celebrities coming up. Alice Walker is going to be here on March 13th on Sunday. It's a fundraiser for the Sebastopol Community Center, which we're so excited to support them. And Michael Krasny is going to be there with her.
There's
only a few tickets left, so call the community center.
And the event is going to be at the French Garden, right?
It is. It's going to be there from 5 to 9.
Yes. So remember that event is not at the store, but at French Garden.
Right. And that brings up a good point is that most of our events are at the store. So when we have posters and on the website, it'll say what store it's at. If not, it will say off-site.
Yes.
And so, for instance, we have Kathleen Shine coming, the Three Weissmans of Westport.
Yes.
And that is going to be in Santa Rosa at the Congregation Shomrei Torah. It's going to be so much fun. I can't wait to read this book. It looks amazing. It's loosely based on Jane Austen's Sense and Sensibility.
Oh, really? I didn't realize that.
So
and set
that.
In Westport, Connecticut.
Right.
Yes, I haven't read that either, but it looks like it's going to be high on my list.
It's so fun. It starts out, Betty Weissman is 75 when Joseph, her husband, divorces her. You know, it's just, it's a great opening. It's going to be fun. And then we have Sammy Hagar on March 26th is coming to Petaluma. So I'm encouraging everyone to wear all their red, rock out, the red rocker. He has actually written a book about his crazy ride through rock and roll, so that should be really fun. Then we have, for the maybe a little more erudite crowd, Sarah Vowell.
Yes, Sarah Vowell sounds very interesting.
She is so
cool.
The
book is about Hawaii.
It is, but it's about the perspective of the natives, but in a way that I think maybe you haven't heard before.
Oh.
It's really cool. And her sardonic wit kind of comes to mind when you think of her, because it's this idea of very tongue-in-cheek, and it's like, did she really just say that? And it's like, oh, I hadn't thought of it that way. But I'm only like a quarter of the way into the book, and I cannot put it down. It's so cool. So that's called Unfamiliar Fishes.
And that will be in Petaluma.
And that's going to be April 1st at 7 p.m. at Petaluma. So these are all definitely there, which is fun. And then backing up March 12th, Saturday, is going to be The Wisdom of the Radish. So this is actually a local girl from Healdsburg, and she took 2 years out of her life to try to make a farm, to make it work with her beloved, and it's really funny. Some of the stuff that she's kind of like, imagine like city girl has to deal with chicken poop, you know, that kind of like, oh my God, wait a minute, this is real. It's really funny. And so she's actually going to also bring baby goats into the store. I mean, I don't care who you are. Baby goats are just so cute. Aww. They're the size of chihuahuas. So
really?
I know. I don't even know what that's going to look like, but I'm totally going to be there.
And that will be at Healdsburg.
At the Healdsburg store, March 12th. It's so fun. Last week we had Nancy Atherton here for Aunt Dimity series. She's a mystery writer. And it's so cool to see people's followers. You know, you've got a crowd come out. We had these ladies who were like, I've been with her since the beginning and have all her books. And it's just, I don't know, it warms the heart when you see someone who is probably 70 years old acting like a teenager.
Really?
Being super excited because her favorite author is there to sign her book, and I just love it.
Yeah, so, that's always a fun moment to see the fans rush up to get their book signed.
Totally. And it makes me happy, too, because it means that people still value books and literature and the thought that goes into it and the thought and time it actually takes. It's not it's not soundbite. You know, you actually have to sit down and read a book and be still sometimes.
And I think Sonoma County is a community of readers.
I hope so.
I've just found that there are people who are so widely read and in all genres. You will find it an amazing place.
I am so excited.
And I think it's a really good fit. You have the enthusiasm and the that it takes to do a job as demanding as yours.
There are a lot of events, and we have some really cool partnerships that are coming up as well. Mm-hmm. Bibliophoria is going to be in the summer, and I'll tell you more about that as it gets closer. And also, just for those of you who are already following the Bibliophoria, there is a teen poetry contest happening, and the deadline has been extended from March 15th to the 30th. So if go to bibliophoria.com, you can find out all about that. This is a chance for local people of all ages to get involved and show us your poetry.
Oh, so all the poets.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And the writers, and there's going to be kids camp, and check out the website. Is going to be super, super cool.
Sounds lovely.
And that is going to coincide with our 30th birthday, which is going to be in June, at the beginning of June. So more on that later, but there's a lot happening.
There is a lot happening. Did we talk about Michelle Hebert?
Oh, we did not. She is has family here, local, and this is another one of those off-site events, but really cool. It's going to be at Devi Yoga Studio in Sebastopol. And so she was a follower of Walt Batiste, who brought yoga to San Francisco. So his daughter still practices in Marin. And he has this huge following that's very steeped in the history of San Francisco and the Hungry Mouth and Haight Street and that whole time period. So you've got nostalgia plus the idea of the yogic warrior journeyer. And she went with him to El Salvador. Amazing story. I don't know. Think Eat, Pray, Love, but smarter.
So. And her name is Michelle Hebert. I mispronounced her name before.
Yes.
And that will be at the Sebastopol store.
Well, it's going to be at Devi Yoga Studio.
Oh, that's right.
Right around the corner.
Yes.
And that'll be on the website as well. And that's April 2nd.
Okay. And we can't leave out a mention of Christy Yamaguchi.
Yes.
My goodness.
So that's going to be incredible. She is going to be here. The schools in the Petaluma area and also the kids in Santa Rosa are going to have a chance to see her. And actually, anyone in Sonoma County can come. Please check the website. All of the school events are open to the public. It's just a great opportunity to see this incredible athlete, mother, and now writer. Dream Big Little Pig is the name of her book. So, yeah,
and she's sort of America's sweetheart. I mean,
well,
from the moment she appeared and when she was still so very young.
Exactly. She looks the same. It's amazing.
I think we've all fallen in love with her and stayed in love with her.
I know. So how great that she's going to be here. And gosh, there's so much. Jacqueline Winspear, A Lesson in Secrets. Yeah. She's a huge name. We're excited about that. And then Langdon Cook. This is kind of an off-the-beaten path. Literally, he is a 21st century forager. So this is the guy that, like, puts his kids on his back and, like, goes into the woods and picks mushrooms and finds things. And it's really, really cool, especially with all the sustainability. And I'm just learning so much that people really care here about.
Yes.
Community living and how we take our resources not for granted.
Oh, yes.
So this is going to be amazing on April 20th. It's called The Fat of the Land, Adventures of a 21st Century Forager. So he's super cool, and he's going to be in Sebastopol.
Now, Katie, if there's anyone out there who hasn't had their attention caught by something that's been presented, I can't imagine. It's such a wonderful mix of interests.
And these are confirmed author events. Yeah. We also have meet and greets.
Oh.
So that's where we service the local author population. So if you are a local author, what you do is you call the store where you'd like to have a meet and greet. And what that is that we give you a space at the front of the store. You can sell your books. There's a consignment contract that you have with the store. And then you basically can sit there in the store, and as people come by, you interact with them. You can sign right there. You can sell books. And that's where you bring in your friends and your family, and you tell people, we can help market a little bit, but it's really on you. We give you the space.
That's a wonderful service.
And those are all on the website, and we have tons of those that just don't have room to be on this calendar.
Yes.
So check the website for those.
Oh, okay. So those would be on the website.
Right, the meet and greets.
Yes. And if someone has a book and they want to do a meet and greet, it tells you on the website how to get in touch.
Or call the store where you're interested.
Call them directly and
say, I'm interested in a meet and greet. I'm a local author.
Uh-huh.
You know, throw out those words, meet and greet, consignment, and they'll know you mean business.
Wonderful. It's been such a pleasure. I'm so glad that you came in, Katie. Katie Casbin is the brand new director of events at Copperfields Bookstore, which is coming up on its 30th anniversary. Amazing that an independent bookstore has remained healthy and vigorous over, and we'll do everything we can to keep the independent bookstores going. They're so important
to
us.
I'm honored to be on your show, well, so thank you.
Thanks so much for coming in.
My pleasure.
Thanks for listening to A Novel Idea. This is Rosemary Manchester, your host. My guests this evening were Heidi Farini and Erin Sheffield about Edith Wharton's The Age of Innocence. If you haven't read The Age of Innocence, you might check it out at the local library and have a go at it. It's really a beautifully written book. And then Katie Casbin, the new coordinator of events at Copperfields, joined me to talk about coming events at Copperfields. And check out the Copperfields website to find out what's going on in the stores in the various locations around Sonoma County. Tune in again next month for A Novel Idea. Thanks to Suzanne Lang, who produces the show. And remember, there's no such thing as too many books.